The symbol of Babylon can't be overestimated in the book of Revelation. This is a word that in the mind of any good Jew would remind them of the terrible things that happened in the history of Israel. Nothing was worse. I suppose some might argue that Antiochus Epiphanes during the intertestamental period, when he desecrated the temple, some of you are familiar with that, would think that may be bad. But I think every Jew would consider the destruction of Babylon in 586 as the ultimate affront by a world leader against God's people. This was the ultimate. And Babylon became this title, this appellation, this banner of derision. And Babylon was obviously not the prized fellow nation of Israel. Turn over to Revelation, the book of Revelation. Let's start in chapter 16. Would be a good place to show you that this word Babylon is used throughout. We could see it in chapter 13. We can see it chapter 14 as well, over there in verse 8. We can see it again in chapter 16 and talking about Armageddon. Look at 16:16. They gathered the kings together to the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon. Seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and out of the temple came a loud voice from the throne saying, "It is done." Came flashes and lightnings and rumblings and peals of thunder, severe earthquake. No earthquake like it had ever occurred since man had been on the earth. So tremendous was the quake. The great city split into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. You see, again, the title Babylon. God is going to come back and destroy this next world government that comes. We talk a lot in the end times discussion about this great leader. What's he known as? Give me some names. Antichrist, though it's not used in Revelation. It's used in the New Testament. What else? What is it? Okay, false prophet's a different individual, but we'll talk about him. Son of perdition, the beast, okay, Antichrist, blah, 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 blah. I can't think of any others either. So here are some of the words. There's like 33, I think. I researched this in a message earlier when we were talking in chapter 13. A lot of titles used for this guy, man of lawlessness. Did we say that one? There is this world leader that's coming. He is going to be the head of a world system. It is rightly called Babylon, but then there are aspects of it. Do you remember chapter 13? It's worth looking at. You're almost there. Turn back to chapter 13. Verses 1 through 10 talked about a beast. Did you remember that? Talked about a beast that was coming out of the sea. He was this leader that would be the ultimate political leader, we said, by the things that it talks about in that section. Verses 11 through 18 talk about the role of a guy who is not a political leader, but as Bill just said, he's what's called later the false prophet. Prophet, religious. I mean, he's this guy speaking for God. Chapter 16 talks about the spirits of demons that will be working through this guy to perform miracles, calling himself a prophet. He's called here the beast out of the earth. In and under the umbrella of Babylon, you can divide this into two parts. A religious organization or part of this, headed by a religious leader called the false prophet or the beast out of the earth. And the other side of it, the political thing, which mostly has had the spotlight in all of prior prophetic history. In other words, in the book of Daniel, you'll read so much about the coming world leader. And we usually focus on that political guy, although there are two. There's a Antichrist or a beast, and then there's the false prophet. There's the beast out of the earth and the beast out of the sea. These two guys lead two parts of one organization. A Babylon, if you will, an ultimate affront to God, a world leadership that you can see as religious and you can see as political. Now, chapter 17. By the way, Babylon is just such a clear characteristic of this because the first reference to Babylon in the Bible, you guys know where that is? Genesis chapter 10 refers to the founding of the city. This guy named Nimrod, there's a name like that. It's got to be a bad city, right? Nimrod founds the city, Babylon. That's not the part you probably know, but in chapter 11, you're familiar with the story of the Tower of Babel, which took place in Mesopotamia there in the Babylonian plains of Shinar. That area became known as Babylon, and that tower was a symbol of their godlessness. That's a good and powerful word. Let's use it. That it was a godless organization. We will make a name for ourselves. We will build this temple up to heaven, See, this usurping, we can do it without God attitude. That is a good label for Babylon. And the Neo-Babylonian kingdom that we read about in Jeremiah 50 and 51 is the ultimate historical reference of Israel or God's people struggling with a godless nation and a godless leader, Nebuchadnezzar. In the book of Revelation, the banner is used symbolically of a coming world system. In chapter 17, we see this again split into two parts. There is a woman and there is a beast. Verse 1, the seven angels who had seven bowls came to me and said, "Come, I'll show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters, and with her the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. And the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, and she was covered, and I'm sorry, it was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. That's a phrase used a lot in the Bible. We'll look at it in a minute. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand filled with the abominable things and filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead, Mystery, Babylon the Great. There it is again. Mother of prostitutes and the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished." We have now a woman on a beast, title Babylon. Here's what I'm trying to say to you, which is an interpretive statement that you need to research for yourself, but here, buy it to understand the rest of my message this morning. The title Babylon can go over both of these. Babylon is the system, not just the woman, which we saw was an adulteress doing things to compromise. It was in the religious system, looked like God, looked to be godly, but in reality was a godless Babylonian type religion. Babylonian, I mean that in the general sense, it was godless. There was Babylon, the political side, which was the actual beast, which was the normal way in the book of Revelation to refer to the political system. So, Babylon. This is not only a religious aspect of the end time world government, it is also a political or governmental aspect of the end times world system. Is anybody still with me? You follow me? Okay. This is a little academic, but we've got to get through some of that to make sense of verses 7 through 10. And I've only picked 4 verses this morning so we can try and make some sense of what's being said here. By the way, like I've said before, I got a large stack of commentaries on Revelation. None of them agree, right, on these things. There are some basics, so I want to stick with the basics. What are the basics that we can pretty well know for sure? Maybe nothing we can know for sure until it happens, because hindsight is 20/20, right? All of this will be clear. I mean, the number of the beast, we said, we can't figure that out. We got to wait to see what happens, and then it'll be clear that that is the number of the beast. But for now, we look in this, we try to get the best picture we can, and we will at least preface it, or I will, in saying I may be wrong. But here are some concepts for you we can try and decipher from what's being said. Verse 7, here's our passage. I'm already tired. Are you tired yet? Verse 7, "Then the angel said to me, 'Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and the beast that she rides, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to," circle this word, "his destruction." That's key in my understanding of what's being said here. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, will come out of the abyss and will go to his destruction. Let's get to that in a minute. A lot of syllables there. The inhabitants of the earth, it was funny to me. The inhabitants of the earth whose names have... You're going, what's he talking about? "Have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world will be astonished at this beast when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. This calls for a mind of wisdom." No duh. Right? "The 7 heads and are 7 hills on which the woman sits. They are also 7 kings. Well, wait a minute. Are they hills or are they kings? They're both. 5 have fallen, 1 is, and the other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for a little while." Okay, I'm going to give this my best shot this morning. Let's try and figure some of this out. Letter A on your outline, we've got letter number 1. We want to take a quick tour of Babylon from afar through our binoculars, okay? Do the best we can. Letter A, what does letter A say? Help me with that. Two sides of Babylon. We've already discussed that, haven't we? See there? It's easier than I thought. Two sides to this. What sides? What aspects? Religious and political, right? Woman and a beast. Both, I think, fall under the heading of Babylon. They obviously are led by two different people, a religious leader, a false prophet, beast out of the earth, a political leader, beast out of the sea, the beast, the Antichrist, the man of lawlessness, son of perdition, little horn, stern-faced king. There, some of them are coming back to me now. Okay. I just want to show you there are two of them there in verse 7. That's what I'm saying. The woman and the beast, she writes, and the beast. This little conjunction makes this first point. There's a woman and a beast. Okay? We've already pretty much established it. In the book of Revelation, we see that. Two aspects to this. Check. Verse 8. What, by the way, seven heads, ten horns, that'll all come up later in the passage. We'll deal with them one at a time today. Seven heads. Next week, ten horns. Verse 8. See, we've mastered verse 7 already. Verse 8, the beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. The beast, person or organization? I tried to give you a hint by circling a personal pronoun. I'm going to say a person, okay? That the beast in the book of Revelation can refer to an organization, and it does, I think, in this passage, an organization with seven heads and ten horns. We'll talk about that later. But in this particular verse, it refers to a person. The beast once was, now is not, will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. He's coming again, right? Not in the God sense. He's going to be here in a sense. Okay, two kings of Babylon. Did I write that on your letter B? Okay, let's try and figure that out. Once was, now is not, and then is coming again, basically. John's writing from the first century perspective. He wrote this during the... what was he, the 12th emperor of Rome, Domitian. Roman Empire is into the first century, Domitian was 87 to 96. So somewhere in this window, the early church writers say that this is when the book of Revelation was written. From his perspective, this king once was, the beast once was, in his time was not, and would come in the future. The symbolism is Babylon. Who was the great opponent of God's people that desecrated the temple in the destruction of Babylon 586? Who was the terrible, ultimate, end all judgment of God to the Israelites in Babylon? His name was Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? His name was Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, and I'm just guessing at this here, was the beast that once was. He was the personification of that kingdom. A lot of people can argue for a lot of different people to identify this with. But he once was. During the time of John, he is saying that he's not here now. But he is going to come again as though, quote unquote, reincarnated, if you will, to come and to serve out this final phase of history where he establishes this kingdom, this world leadership. Are you saying, Mike, that Nebuchadnezzar is going to be reincarnated and lead this world? Is that the Antichrist? No. No more than John the Baptist was Elijah. That's a trick question, right? Was John the Baptist Elijah? How many of you say yes? Was John the Baptist Elijah? How many of you say no? Okay, two of you took the test. Yeah, you're both wrong and right. However you want to see it. John the Baptist was, when Jesus was asked, is this John the Baptist? I'm sorry, is John the Baptist the Elijah who was to come? What did Jesus say? Yeah. Now, did John the Baptist sit around saying, boy, I remember when I was there and that chariot came down, swept me up, and old Elisha was over here. That, what a time we had, and those kids coming up. Did he do any of that? We're not talking about a literal reincarnation here. But he was serving in the role of Elijah, because Malachi 3 said that Elijah would come as a forerunner to the Messiah. He came in the days of the kings of the middle monarchy, and he also came during the period of Christ, and his name was John the Baptist. Was he reincarnated Elijah? No. Did he serve in the role? Yes. Nebuchadnezzar was this beast who was. He was not during the day of John, and John looked ahead and said one day he would come back, so to speak. He would come out like he's crawling out of the abyss. The bottomless pit, literally, this place of sin, this place of torment, and he would come back, so to speak, and he would be this person going to his destruction. That's a popular way that Paul likes to refer to him. He's destined for perdition or destruction. All right. So here's what I'm saying. There are two kings to Babylon. The kind of quote-unquote Babylon. This is all quote-unquotes here. Two kings. Nebuchadnezzar served as the historical prototype. This is turning out to be a good sentence. Nebuchadnezzar served to be the prototype, and the Antichrist, which I don't like to use because that's not really the word used here. I mean, that's the guy, but it sounds so negative, and he's going to be such a loved, beloved leader. We need to think of him more as a world leader. He will be the world leader who is coming and will be destroyed by God himself, according to the book of Revelation and Daniel 7 and Daniel 9. Okay. Great. What will the people think of this new coming king? The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, they will be astonished when they see the beast, this person, who once was, now is not, yet will come. I understand there are other ways to look at this passage. I'm just giving you my best after grappling with it for weeks now. Okay? Now, this is all academic, and I don't apologize for it, although I feel like I should, because I know some of you aren't used to thinking very hard on Sunday mornings, but you've got to get this into your thinking to try and at least understand what we've just said. There is a coming king. There is a kingdom that is coming that is represented by the symbolic title Babylon. It has two aspects, religious and political. Okay, verse 9. What I want to do, and I called it cutely enough, tritely enough, the Babylonian Survival Guide. Okay, let's see what that's all about. This calls for a mind with wisdom, which is usually when I break my pencil and give up. All right. You guys aren't very happy this morning, are you? Either that or I'm a whole lot funnier in my mind than I think I am. I really am. Okay. Seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. Seven heads are the seven hills on which the woman sits. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. When he comes, he must remain for a little while. Now I'm going to do the old switcheroo on you here. We talked about the beast as being an individual because of the personal pronoun, and the best guess is to try to understand that. Now we see that it's also, that this beast has seven manifestations, seven heads, and those seven heads of this beast are really the seven hills on which the woman sits, and they are also seven kings. Okay. The popular interpretation of this is that there are obviously no doubt in the mind of the first century person that the seven hills are probably the classic reference to the seven hills on which Rome is built. That makes sense, but I'm going to go a different route on this. It seems to me that to try and figure out what it means that five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come, is to look at the whole flow of biblical history. We've got to understand that in the Old Testament, it's very common to refer to a government or a nation as a mountain or a hill. Matter of fact, the hills are going to be smashed by the great mountain of God's kingdom. This woman has seven, or this beast, rather, has seven heads, and the seven heads represent seven mountains, and they also represent seven kings. Now, it's not much of a stretch if we see that mountains are the kingdoms and the kings are the rulers of the kingdom. Does that make it easier? And if we think about it that way, that there have been five great kingdoms and five great kings that the people of God have had to deal with, and those five kings have passed, I'm sorry, there's seven total, seven heads. Five have already gone, one is happening during John's day, and one will yet come. Is anybody still with me? Are you tracking with that? Five have fallen, one is happening during John's day, and one has not yet come. Okay, do you see your worksheet there? You got blank versus blank. On the right-hand side, blank versus boom, there, that. I want to just list the seven world powers, which is pretty undisputed. There were seven powers that had ultimate despotic authority. Let's start in the beginning. Who was the first? Egypt, right? So let's just jot these down. We're going to fill in the right-hand side. Egypt was the first real world power that had ultimate authority. I suppose there's some debate and dispute about that, but I mean, it was the one that really had established itself as the great world leader. Second world leader, world kingdom, the mountain, had a king. Egypt had the Pharaoh. What was the next one? Syria, right? Assyria, we need to call it. Assyria was the next great kingdom, and the people of God had to deal with the Assyrian king. Shalmaneser IV, to be precise, was the worst of the bunch to have to deal with if you're a person of God. We'll talk about that. So you had Egypt and the Pharaohs, and you had You had Assyria and Shalmaneser and Sennacherib and a few others that were pain in the butt to God's people. Then you got the next one. What's the next one? Babylon. We need to teach you guys world history here, right? Assyria, what's next? Babylon. Babylon, or Neo-Babylon, the real Babylon proper, was the next world leader. And you know some of the leaders there, right? Nabopolassar was a great world leader, probably one of the strongest it had. And the worst for God's people, Nebuchadnezzar, the prototype of the beast, if you will, in my book. So you got Egypt and the pharaohs, and you got Assyria and Sennacherib and Shalmaneser the IV, who was ultimately the destroyer of the northern kingdom in 721. You have Babylon, Neo-Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. This is all on the right side, by the way, the kingdoms. What's next after Babylon? If you know your Daniel, book of Daniel, you'll know what's next. What's next? Because that's where Daniel starts. He starts with, there's Babylon, and then there's Medo-Persia. Medo-Persia, the Medes and the Persians got together and conquered Babylon, basically. It's a synopsis. And became the next world leader. Okay, we have Cyrus and Darius and Xerxes and Artaxerxes, if you know some of those stories in the period of the exile of Israel. So we've got leaders there that were a pain in the butt as well, if I can say that. So Egypt, we had Assyria, number two. Then we had Babylon. You can call it Neo-Babylon if you want. Then we had Medo-Persia. What came after Medo-Persia? Greece. Great. We're catching on. Greece was the next world government, right? Alexander the Great and all the Antiochus family and all those leaders that were also a pain to the people of God. The next true world government after that, obviously, was... Yeah, good. You all know that one. Rome. Rome was the next, and it was the one that was during John's day. Five had fallen. What were the five? Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece. Those had fallen in John's day. There was one that was. What was the ruling government of the day? Rome. One was to come, and it was only going to come for a short while. That next true world government is the one we're all talking about in the book of Revelation. It is, because of the way it's linked with Rome in the book of Daniel, and even kind of connected with Rome in the book of Revelation, we call it kind of Rome phase two, or whatever. I just call it the world government of the next great world leader. It's coming. The whole push toward the uniting of our world government, this is the next, well, whether it's this one or the next one after that, but whatever, it's the next world government that really is controlled by a despotic, autocratic leader, okay, the Antichrist, the beast, the son of perdition, the man of lawlessness. Okay, that's the one that's coming. Now, have we made some sense of this a little bit? Tried to. There are seven kings and seven hills, if you will. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. When he does come, he must remain for a little while. I've saved verse 11, though it's part of the same paragraph, for next week to tie us into some other things that I want to touch on. Now, is that enough academics for now? What I'd like to do is to inspire you, if I can, just a little by recalling some Sunday school stories that relate to each of these kingdoms. Okay? Our first hero, this is the left-hand side of the column now, the first hero to stand up against the poo-poo of Egypt was who? Moses. Jot that down, would you? May Moses serve as a guide for you and I, as a guy who stood up against the, really, what? Well, let's look at a passage that gives us a great commentary on this, Hebrews chapter 11. I love the way it puts it, so we might as well read this. Hebrews 11, verse 24. Now, Moses had it made, right? You remember the whole story? He got dunked in the basket in the river, and he's floating down the river, and sister and mom are hanging out there watching what happens, and the Pharaoh's daughters are bathing. They pull out little baby Moses, and they say, wow, what a good-looking kid. He's a Hebrew boy. We ought to get a Hebrew lady to nurse this kid, and oh, hey, can you find somebody? Yeah, it happens to be his mother. I'll pay you to do it. What a good, sweet deal, right? And all of a sudden, Moses grows up now, known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, raised in Pharaoh's house. All the advantages, best schooling, best universities, everything, he had it made. Do you think he had a sweet deal? Man, he was the little adopted child of Pharaoh's daughter. Hebrews 11, 24 says, by faith, and that's what this whole message is about, that you and I need to have full confidence that we are not a part of this world system. He refused, when he had grown up, he refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. I don't want your world government. I don't want your power. I don't want your pagan way of ruling life. He chose rather to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace,
for the sake of Christ, which was a long way off, as greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. Wow, that's a huge mouthful. Here is Moses saying, I don't value, catch this now, the world's entertainment, if you want to put it that, enjoying. Moses, I put it this way, was not busy enjoying the world. Could Moses have enjoyed the world? You bet. Where did he end up? In the desert, shepherding some sheep and going out there trying to split up fights and all this. You know the story. What a terrible choice. Moses, you could have been a good little follower of Yahweh in the palace and could have driven a nice camel and could have had, you know, nice whatever canoe out there on the river Nile. But no, you had to be counterculture. You had to say, I'm not going to enjoy this world. I wonder how many of us get tied up in the enjoyments of this world. This message is all about knowing that we are, what's the subtitle? Something about, you know, surviving as an alien or thriving as an alien. Is that what it says? In a foreign land. We as Christians are called aliens and strangers. Moses saw himself that way. He wasn't going to get too comfortable in this world. How comfortable are you? That's the real challenge this morning. Let me remind you of another guy who stood up to the next world power, Assyria. Maybe you don't know much about him, but his name is Hosea. Hosea was a prophet trying to speak to the 10 northern tribes of Israel. It was a tough, tough situation because in the midst of all of his prophesying, the people were saying, chill out, Hosea. What's wrong with you? Assyria, this great world power, will take care of us. They were looking to Assyria for their provision. Here's how one prophecy of Hosea puts it. Hosea 5:11, if you're taking notes through 13, jot it down. Ephraim is oppressed and trampled in judgment, intent on pursuing idols, God says. I'm like a moth to Ephraim. I'm just an annoyance. I'm like rot to the people of Judah. I just something they want to get rid of. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his sores, then Ephraim turned to Assyria and sent to the great king, quote unquote, for help. But he is not able to cure you. He will not heal your sores. Here is a world that Hosea lived in under the domination of the next world power when everyone thought it was cool and convenient to find their sustenance, their support, their strength, their help. As I put it, they were intent on relying on the world. Moses said, I won't enjoy the world. I'm not interested in enjoying the world. Hosea said, I'm not interested in relying on the world either. Aliens and strangers don't sit around and see how much they can enjoy the world. Aliens and strangers don't sit around and say, we're going to rely on the world either. This is a good place. We'll put our strength in that. If you're taking notes, you may want to jot down the whole 14th chapter of Hosea, the final words, and note the words that come from Hosea's mouth and not God's. He said, we have sinned by relying on Assyria. We have sinned by trying to find our hope and salvation in them. We need to know that our hope and salvation is in God. And how often do we in this world seek the world's advice and the world's counsel to try and get help? The Bible says, man, I'm a fountain of living water, and you guys are hewing for yourself cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. We're looking in all the wrong places for answers. As people of God, we should be aliens in that respect. Third world government was Babylon. There's no better story or inspiring Sunday school flannel graph thing that I've ever seen than the three teenage boys in the fiery furnace. Do you remember that? Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or you know them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these three guys. I love that story. Have you read that lately in Daniel chapter 3? They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, you know what? You can heat your furnace up. You can get it real hot. You can throw us in it. They said, but you know what? We are not interested in bowing to your idol. And as a matter of fact, we know God can save us. But I love this line. Even if he does not deliver us, we'll have you know, sir, we're not interested in bowing down to your idols. I love that. If Moses was one who wasn't going to get caught up in enjoying the world, and Hosea was one who wasn't going to get tied up depending on the world, these four teenage boys were certainly not concerned with fitting into the world, because all they had to do was do their little deal. And you know how the story started in Daniel chapter 1. These three guys and Daniel said to the leader, the chief official, we don't want your stinking food either. That's a little particle in the Hebrew that doesn't translate very well, but we don't want your stinking food. You can take all that stuff. You can take your Babylonian ways and all the little wine and all your delicacies that you pour out to the gods and then try to serve to us. We don't want it. We're not interested in fitting in. And how often we're busy entertaining ourselves with the world, trying to get our dependence and sustenance from the world, and then even trying to fit into the world. That's not what aliens and strangers do. Certainly not what they should do in their Babylon. Speaking of Babylon, on the heels of Babylon came Medo-Persia, and you know Daniel had a lot of problems with the leaders of Medo-Persia. You remember the story, don't you? Darius was the great leader of the kingdom. He had these governors, these officials, these administrators, these satraps, all these people doing business for him who got ticked off at Daniel because he was getting special treatment, seemed to be the little Jewish boy who was always getting favors from Darius. We know what we'll do. We'll get Darius to sign a law that says you can't pray to anybody but the great King Darius. Hey, Darius, how does that sound? That's a great campaign thing. We'll just have there be a law in the land that no one can pray to anybody but you. You remember that? He signed it, and out went the decree. And the Bible says in Daniel chapter 6 that when Daniel heard of the decree, he went to his house, he climbed up in his room, he opened the windows toward Jerusalem, and he prayed as he always did. You know, if Egypt's a great place to get entertained and aliens are saying no, and Assyria is a great place to depend on, and Hosea is saying, forget it, I'm not gonna. And if you got the three teenage boys in Babylon saying, we're not interested in fitting in, you certainly have a Daniel who stands in the face of the next world power and says, I am not interested in calming down my religious practices for you. If you're wanting me to not be a fanatic in your kingdom, you can forget about it. And how many of us try to avoid the label Jesus freak, fanatic, right? Dude, we're aliens and strangers. Go ahead and think me a fanatic, because that's what I am. I'm passing through. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece. We don't know much about this story because we're good Protestants that don't carry around that set of books called the Apocrypha. And though they are not inspired by God, I believe firmly, they do reflect the history between the Testaments. God's word was silent. Prophets weren't speaking, but there were guys writing down stories that were happening. And in the height of the Grecian Empire, and when they were flexing their muscles in Jerusalem, a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes came in. He was the fourth in a line of Antiochuses, and he came forth and said, all of this religious stuff has got to stop. He made circumcision illegal, punishable by death, keeping the Sabbath illegal, punishable by death. He came into the temple. He desecrated it. He sacrificed a pig on the altar. He put in temple prostitutes in Jerusalem, and he said, I'm the world leader. What are you going to do about it? And there was a guy named Judas Maccabeus. Hard to spell, but you may want to put it in that blank there. Judas Maccabeus, and all you good Protestants, don't get scared. I'm not turning to Apocrypha for spiritual truth. I'm just stating a historical event that is inspiring to me as a person living in my Babylon. Judas Maccabeus stood up to the world leader and said to Antiochus Epiphanes, you know what? I'm not going to sit by and passively let you attack my God. He sounds so much like the great story of King David before he was a king, who stood at the sidelines when Goliath sat there in that valley and said, hey, you punks, what are you going to do? You got a God, you think you're great, you think your God is the king of the world. Look at me, send a guy out to fight me, and if I lose, I'll be your servant. If you lose, you'll be our servant. And they stood there on the top of that ridge with all their knees knocking, and a young kid named David came out to deliver bread and cheese to his brothers and said, hey, what's going on here, guys? And he sees this huge guy standing down in the valley mocking the people of God. And David said, I can't handle that. He said, what are you guys going to do about this? And they sat around saying, duh, it's pretty big. And you know what? All the people in Israel during the Grecian domination in Jerusalem were standing back saying, what can we do? We can't take on Antiochus Epiphanes. We can't take on the whole Grecian Empire. And there was a guy named Judas Maccabeus in 1 Maccabees chapter 4 that said, fine, I'll do it then. If no one else will do it, I'll do it. And the historians write about Maccabeus' leadership. He said, perhaps no army, one historian writes, has ever had higher morale than the force with which Judas won his brilliant victories against numerically superior forces. Antiochus had no option but to conclude peace with Judas and withdraw the abominable decrees of 165 B.C. Amid great rejoicing, Judas marched to Jerusalem. The temple was solemnly cleansed and the worship of God was restored. One guy sat back and said, I'm not going to be passive if you're going to attack my God. Moses was saying, I'm not interested in being entertained by your world. If you had Hosea saying, I'm not going to depend on your world, Assyria. And you had these four teenage Israeli boys saying to Babylon, I'm not interested in fitting in. And Daniel saying, I'm not going to calm down and not be a Jesus freak for you, a God freak. You had Judas Maccabeus saying, I'm not going to be passive. You then reach the current Roman Empire, which is the sixth in the line, which John says now is. What was John's advice? I just put John down. John versus Rome. What was his attitude toward the world at the time? What did he say in 1 John chapter 2 about the world? I love this passage. Let me read it for you. He gets right to the heart of what the problem was. He said, don't love the world. 1 John 2:15 through 17. Actually, we'll go to 18 if you're looking at it with me. 1 John 2:15, don't love the world or anything in the world. The world for them was this Roman system, this world government. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him, because you know what the Roman system was all about? It was all about the cravings of sinful nature, the lust of the eyes, the boasting of what man has and what he does. All that doesn't come from the Father. It comes from the current world system. The world and its desires are going to pass away, but the man who does the will of God abides forever. Dear children, it's the last hour, and as you've heard, the Antichrist is coming. Even now, many Antichrists have come. This is how we know it's the last hour. He says, we're living in my Babylon right now. My Babylon is not the Babylon that is to come, this great world empire, this revived Roman empire. But it's bad, and I'm telling you, I'm not going to get tied up loving it. And again, it's reminiscent of Moses' decision. I'm not going to sit here and admire the world and fall in love with it. James said the same thing. Friendship with the world says it's hostility toward God. John versus Rome. John said, I'm not going to love this world system. I'm not going to concern myself with loving the world. Lastly, the end time world power, I don't know how you wrote that down, Rome phase two, whatever it is, it's this coming world government. And there's going to be a group of Christians, thank God it won't be us if we make the commitment to follow Christ now, but there will be a group of what I call tribulation Christians that are going to be up against the toughest battle of their lives. But the Bible says they will be overcomers and they will stand in the face of that leader. And then when he says, take the mark or you can't eat, buy or sell, they'll say, fine then. I'm not taking your mark, and I'm not going to fit into your world, and I'm not going to enjoy it, and I'm not going to submit to it, I'm not going to bow to your idols, I'm not going to eat your food, then fine. And the text holds these tribulational saints up as a great example of commitment, determination, and resolve to say no to their world and yes to a God they couldn't even see. It's easy for us to bash the old Heaven Gate cult thing. Remember that when that hit the news? I mean, I saw Christians everywhere doing this. Distancing themselves from that. I'm not advocating what they did there. But you know what? It's a real sign of whether or not our faith is real. The Bible says in Philippians chapter 3 that you and I are not citizens of this earth. Now that may be a doctrinal statement that kind of floats in and out of someone's mind without any effect, but the next phrase says, from which we eagerly await a Savior, who is Jesus Christ, our Lord. Think about that. Do you eagerly await to see Christ? Do you want it so bad that you can reflect the thoughts of Paul that in Philippians chapter 1 says, you know what, for me to live is Christ, that's a good thing, but for me to die, that's gain. He says, I don't know which to choose. To live on in the flesh would mean fruitful labor, right, for Christ. But it's fruitful labor, see. It is much better, he says, I desire to depart. Did you hear what he said? I desire to depart. What does that mean, guys? Die and be with Christ. I'm not pushing the Heaven's Gate cult, and none of our punch will be spiked out here after the service. But do you desire to depart and be with Christ? If you don't, I fear that your relationship with God is not genuine. Oh, is that judgmental? I don't necessarily enjoy the path to the departing, right? I would like to walk through it painlessly in my sleep. But the concept is that in my mind, if given the chance tomorrow to live in this world on Monday or live there with him on Monday, I choose there. But because God does not give me the right to take my life into my own hands, and as Paul rightly says, he's worrying about a prayer request. I'm in prison. I don't know how to pray. Should I pray that God just send me to my execution? That'd be great. I get promoted. Or should I pray that I'll get delivered so I can live on for you? Paul says it's more fruitful for me to live on. I'll continue on. But you know where my heart is? My heart is not here. It's there. That's the only way Moses could say no. That's the only way Hosea could say no. That's the only way these Hebrew boys, teenage boys, could say no. That's the only way Daniel could say no. That's the only way Judas Maccabeus could say no. It is the only way that John could say no. It's the only way the tribulational saints can say no. It's the only way you and I can say no to this world. If we look it square in the eye and say, this is not my home, I am an alien, a stranger, I'm just passing through. Take the example we just touched on them. Study all of those, would you? All seven of those periods of time and those great heroes, particularly the first five that we've already seen pass prior to the time of the New Testament, great Old Testament, intertestamental stories of people who said, you know what, the world's not my home. I'm not interested in fitting in. And then take that and lay it up against your life and look at the strivings in your life and in my life to try and fit in, be comfortable, be entertained, admire this world, not be called a freak in this world, enjoy the world. Just stand with me. Let's close in prayer. God, important time for us this morning to hear a little bit of the academic side of this passage. We want to be good students of your word. We want to understand it. We want to know what's going on here. And I admit humbly before this congregation that I'm just giving my best shot at understanding some of these things in this passage. Though a lot of that makes sense to me, there may be a tweaking here and there, a little bit different hindsight, and we'll definitely be 2020. But the main things that we know is that there will be a world government, there will be a world leader, and people of God are going to have to say no to that. And though we don't live in the midst of the Babylon of that end time period, of which the Babylon of the Old Testament was a prototype, God, we live in our own Babylon. A world government that has a lot of values that we shouldn't buy into. A lot of things trying to calm us down so that we're not too out of the ordinary and draw out of the box too far. Help us, God, to reject all that, to be a little bit more bold. Inflame in our hearts a sense of being a little bit more revolutionary. Being people that are willing and gutsy enough to stand up and say, I don't want any of this world stuff, and I'm willing to stand up and be different. Give us that resolve, I pray, in the midst of this world that doesn't much care about you, certainly doesn't care about people that are committed to you. Give us success in this, I pray, in the authority of Christ, your Son.